Brad, please, let's get out of here.
For God's sake, keep a grip on yourself, Janet.
But it seems so unhealthy here.
It's just a party, Janet.
Well, I want to go.
Well, we can't go anywhere till I get to a phone.
Well, then ask the butler or someone.
Just a moment, Janet. We don't want to interfere with their celebrations.
This isn't the Junior Chamber of Commerce, Brad.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own. They may do some more folk dancing.
Look, I'm cold, I'm wet, and I'm just plain scared.
I'm here with nothing to worry about.
How'd you do, I see you've met my faithful handyman. He's just a little broad dime, because when you knocked, he thought you were the candy man. Don't get strung out by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover. I'm just a sweet transvestite.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is part two of our special rock and roll biopic and rock and roll movie episode extravaganza. When we last left off, we heard of Teal's recollections of seeing the Rocky Horror Picture Show as an impressionable youth, and now we will hear from myself and my adventures seeing the Rocky Horror Picture Show. L.A. and New York first. Those were the two places where it really started to take off. But yeah. one of the third places was Boston. There was an old theater in downtown Boston, or the Back Bay, the Exeter Street Theater used to play it.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever heard about it was maybe a year or two after it originally came out. My mom had read an article in the Boston Globe. And she started telling me, she's like, you know, I wish we could go, like, you were a little older. There's this movie I hear about. It's called the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And people throw rice at a wedding and then they have squirt guns and they shout at the screen and it sounds like a blast. That's all. I didn't know anything about this movie other than that. And then in the early 80s, when it was still the Exeter Street Theater, my dad, one of his cousins, was much younger than he was. She was in college, and we were all down at my aunt's cottage in the summer, and she and her college friends went and saw it. So she started talking all about it. And as a movie fan, it became one of my bucket list things that I had to go to see this Rocky Horror. I mean, I thought about it all the time. And eventually it moved to the Harvard Square Cinema. And on my 15th birthday, as a gift, my mom and dad took me and my friend Robert to go to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And it was, I mean, for years at Harvard Square, it was a big deal.
Yes, it was a huge deal. Yeah.
They did the whole review at the beginning where you had people that were dressed up.
Right.
And a lot of the people in the crowd were dressed up and everybody knew the lines. And we saw it at a, you know, it was sold out. And my parents, my dad was a bit of a conservative guy. And let's just say he didn't know anything about what the movie was.
I cannot see your dad liking this movie.
Yeah. He did not. It was a little awkward. I think it would have been more fun if he wasn't there. But it was such a wild thing to watch all these people shout things at the screen. And
yeah.
It was just a very exciting thing. And I remember when it was over, I was like, I don't even know if I really liked that movie, but I liked the experience and I just couldn't wait to be able to go again. And then like a year later, I was working at the movie theater in town and there was an older kid. And one night he said to like got a few of us, hey, we're going to go into town. We're going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And my mom, for whatever reason, she had met this guy and she thought he was like a really nice guy. And thought, oh yeah, he's okay.
No, fine. Go with him.
Yeah, so I go with him and like three other kids. He was like probably like 18 or I don't know, in 19 or 20 or something. And so we thought, oh, this guy's a god, you know. But in reality, he was like a geeky guy hanging out with like, you know, 16-year-olds. And so he like takes us. The first thing that happens is he get on the highway, and there was nobody around, and he just this was really crazy. He does a 360 on the highway.
Oh man. Show off.
And I was scared to death. I'm like, we're going to die. And this guy is dangerous. And I don't know if we should be in the car with him. And so we get down to Harvard Square, and he, like, has his whole bag full of toilet paper. This guy is serious. He's in for seriousness. And he is an aggressive Rocky Horror person. He's, like, chucking big chunks of tissue at people. He's soaking it first. Like, this is not how the Rocky Horror picture is supposed to go. He's very obnoxious. And even the most obnoxious of my friends that were with us from the movie theater were all looking at each other like, what the hell is this guy's problem? And so we were there for maybe a half an hour, and we got kicked out.
Because of him.
Because of this guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was humiliated. And I'm like, how am I – like, now I'm like, what are we going to do? If I came home now,
right.
And my mom's like – and I have to say, well, we got kicked out. That's not going to go over well. So he's driving around. He takes us in to the combat zone in Boston because he thought it would be funny, right? So now he's parked and we're all walking around like scared kids in the combat zone with this crazy guy. And so, needless to say, then it was like, it wasn't until I had my own license that me and my friend Robert started to go down with frequency in my senior year to see the Rocky Horror. And we basically went a lot just so that we could, like, you know, learn the lingo and say the stuff. And so my senior year, I probably saw it a good half a dozen to a dozen times.
Yeah, I think that's probably about how many times I saw it in the theater.
Yeah. And then, you know, you just kind of like, then, you know, you move on.
Yes. you do. You kind of, but now it seems like, I mean, I guess it's still a thing in some places, but I think home video kind of took a lot of the wind out of the sails because there was a while there when Rocky Horror was just not available on video.
For years.
For years. And so the only way to see it was these midnight shows, basically.
Yeah, or like there would be, like you go to these comic book conventions and there'd be these bootleg copies.
Yes.
Song of the South, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and the Rolling Stones Cocksucker Blues.
That's right. Lineup. Yep. That's the pirate lineup.
It's, you know, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it was. So we were talking about Rocky Horror, and one of the actors in Rocky Horror is Meatloaf.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this, and I'm glad you're going there.
And Meatloaf made a movie directed by Alan Rudolph, of all people.
Good old Alan Rudolph.
This is not your typical Alan Rudolph movie. I don't know, you know, if our listeners...
Which basically means it's an Alan Rudolph movie.
Which basically means, yeah. No, but there's a few Alan Rudolph movies. There's like three or four that kind of all go together, like Choose Me and Love It Large. They kind of all have the same feel to them.
The Moderns.
Yeah, but this
movie... Yeah, He hit his stride sort of in the like early 80s to like the early 90s.
Exactly. Yeah. Trouble in Mind, Choose Me.
Equinox.
Let's see. Love It Large, Made in Heaven, Trouble in Mind. Yeah.
Dorothy Parker and the Vicious Circle.
Yep.
As you can tell, you and I are Alan Rudolph aficionados.
We like Alan Rudolph. I think we even saw Equinox together.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, we really liked that. That's a kind of like a hidden gem movie. I don't know if it holds up. I haven't seen it in years. But
yeah, I haven't seen it in years, but I kind of want to watch it again. So anyhow, Meatloaf and Alan Rudolph did this movie called Roadie.
Yep, which everybody might know from the Eddie Rabbit song, Driving My Life Away.
Oh, really?
Okay. Before we read it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
That was like the hit song from Roadie.
Yes.
Roadie is a very interesting and kind of a fun movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a sort of a rock and roll spirit kind of movie. It's about a guy who just wants to be the greatest roadie ever.
And, you know, who else doesn't?
And who doesn't? But he's also kind of like a genius. He's some sort of savant with electronics. And
That's right.
And it's just sort of an outrageous, over-the-top comedy, sort of silly comedy.
It was designed for the drive-ins, basically.
It was designed for the drive-ins, and it's a great drive-in movie. I like this movie. I know it doesn't have the greatest reputation, but yeah, it definitely is on my rock and roll list, high up, actually.
It seems like there are certain filmmakers that just gravitate towards the rock and roll biopic.
Yes.
Taylor Hackford.
Taylor Hackford, definitely.
He is the director of a few different movies, like Against All Odds, but just not a rock and roll movie. But he also did Officer and a Gentleman. But he produced La Bamba, which is actually one of the better rock and roll biopics.
Yes.
Which is an interesting choice because it told the lesser known of one of the people that died on the same plane crash as Buddy Holly, which is Ritchie Valens.
Was there ever a big bopper movie?
There was not the bop. No, there was not a big bopper movie to my knowledge, though the big bopper does show up in La Bamba. And what was interesting is that, you know, here's a time where they weren't making a lot of movies about, you know, Latino culture. And this film does explore that. And he actually took an extra step where the film was actually shot twice. Once with English and once in Spanish.
Okay, so they just did every scene twice.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I thought that was a very interesting approach. Again, maybe this is just because of Taylor Hackford's personal history or something. He made this film called The Idol Maker.
Which I have not seen.
It's really weird. I have, but it's been years. And this is the strange thing. It's based on a music producer named Bob Marcucci. And he's the guy who discovered Fabian and Frankie Avalon. So that's already a weird thing to do a biopic on. But it's only loosely based. They basically changed the name. So it's a very strange movie to make a film that you're not even using the actor, the performers, and have a fake Frankie Avalon and a fake Fabian. It's just a very strange movie. And then, of course, Taylor Hackford also did the Ray Charles story, Ray.
Yes.
And I feel like Ray has fallen into that. This is the way musical biopics are now. There's an incident at the beginning that haunts the child.
Yes.
And then makes them a tortured soul later. And then they get involved in drugs. And then they beat drugs at the end.
Yes.
And demons are exposed. Walk the Line was very similar.
Walk the Line, totally the same movie. I mean, it's amazing that they keep making these, even though they all have the same story, just different music.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a formula, and people seem to like it. But that's why I like movies that are a little bit different. One movie that's way different, and it was interesting. It was one of those that they just didn't have the rights or couldn't afford the rights to the music. Right. So they instead focused on the group before they were famous.
Oh, you're talking about Backbeat.
I'm talking about Backbeat. Yes, the Beatles movie. And I like films that they decide to just look into one little select part of the story. And that was before they became famous.
Yeah, and it's Stu Sutcliffe, right?
Yeah, Stu Sutcliffe and John Lennon. It's primarily about their friendship. And their friendship with the photographer in Germany. Was it Astrid
that
created their look? And so they don't have any of the Beatles songs. It's just kind of like songs that they might have performed while they were in Germany.
Right.
It's not a very high energy film. And I think it's kind of forgotten. It's not shown a lot, but I just kind of like it because I'm just happy that it exists and they didn't try to do too much of the Beatles story.
Yeah, I liked it at the time. It made me just think of that Across the Universe movie, another, you know, Beatles.
See, I like that. And it's funny is that was the film I was thinking that parts of Rocket Man reminded me of was Across the Universe.
Yes, I can see that. Well, it's like a rock musical in a way.
With Julie Taymor kind of just, I mean, it's a visual feast, right?
Now, where would you put a movie, since we're talking about rock musicals, where would you put a movie like The Wall?
Ooh, now that's a good one. That's sort of, you know, the rock opera. There's like that's a whole subgenre, right? So you have films like Quadrophenia that they attempt to kind of take a rock album and then put it on screen.
In a way.
I really love Quadrophenia, and I mean, The Wall is great.
The Wall is great, too, yeah. But, it's interesting. Yeah, they're rock musicals, basically. And
there's a movie, by the way, and I'm sure. I don't know. I can't be sure, because you saw a lot on video from the video store, but did you ever see The Wall in the theater?
Again, this was a movie that this guy, Russ, would play at the Colonial Theater on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, the 80s, that was kind of a big midnight movie.
It was a big midnight movie, and my friends loved to go see it. Yeah, so I saw that a couple times in the theaters. He tended to play, like, he played Ziggy Stardust midnight one time.
You know what was another movie that they used to play a lot at midnight? It was another movie that notoriously played in Cambridge for like 3 years straight in the 70s. And it was probably because of the heavy Jamaican population in Cambridge.
Oh,
but it became
yeah.
a cult film was The Harder They Come.
I can't believe I didn't have that on my list. That's a great...
I wrote it down. I was like, thought about it late. Yeah, I love The Harder They Come. It took me years to watch it. Like, I knew the album, like everybody did, the soundtrack, yes. way before I knew about what the movie was about.
And the movie is really strange.
It's really strange, but what it's really great is... It feels like a documentary, like you were just dropped
yes.
into Jamaica in 1972, and this is what it is. It's a very immediate film.
But at the same time, parts of it are really immediate and almost documentary-like, and parts of it are surreal.
Yes.
Where it actually, yeah, separates itself from reality and becomes sort of magical.
Yep. So, The Harder They Come, again... Why that's a rock and roll movie is that it's a film where literally it helped popularize
yeah.
the Jamaican sound of rock and roll to mainstream America.
Yeah.
I mean, that soundtrack is one of the key soundtracks.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Hugely influential. And yeah, it's just it's a movie that I can't really highly recommend because it's not that easy to watch.
Well, you know, for movie fans, yeah, it is. It's a little hard, but
what I'm saying is, it's not just you know, sit down and watch. I like the movie too, but it's
well, it's shot on like really awful, grainy,
yes,
film stock from another country.
Exactly.
I don't know how they made film back there, but it was just yikes.
Yeah. So it's
super gritty.
It's super gritty. Yeah, you just got to know what you're getting into, and it's a little bit of almost just a view into another time and place.
Yeah, for most people, just stick with the soundtrack.
Yes. Yeah, the movie is for the completionist. I don't know. We're so far...
Go on.
We're so far out of our subgenres at this point. We're just covering like six different subgenres.
Well, if we were really doing our job, we would ahead of time pick... A specific set of films that adhered to the subgenre, and he said we're going to just do these and nothing else. But that's not us.
That's not how we do it.
We could have broke this off. We could have got five episodes out of this, and instead we got one like sort of half-assed episode. No. I think it's a good episode. I can't wait to hear it again. Another movie that's great is Love and Mercy.
I have not seen that. Yeah,
it's really really good. Kind of tells you the Brian Wilson, kind of what led to his breakdown and then kind of
right.
his sort of redemption. But there's two great performances in it. Paul Dano playing the young mm-hmm. Brian Wilson and John Cusack, which I think offline we were talking about how what the hell's happened to that guy. But
yeah.
you know, occasionally he does a really good performance and this was one of them.
Well, he's a good actor. He's just made some poor choices. Okay, I'm just going to keep throwing out titles. Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes. that's a crazy movie.
It's a crazy...
It's Brian De Palma.
Yeah, it's Brian De Palma doing a musical
with Paul Williams.
With Paul Williams.
and debut of Jessica Harper.
Yeah, and I would say if I was going to double feature it, I might put it with Streets of Fire.
Ooh, I am going to go with... Ken Russell's Tommy.
Oh.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten to Ken Russell and his musicals. Like The Music Lovers, which is a movie that nobody has seen. I have seen. Literally, I went my freshman year. I was on campus at USC, and I was supposed to see Women in Love. And they're like, we didn't get the print for that. But guess what we got? We got The Music Lovers. And I sat and watched the whole thing of that, and that was this bizarre version of Tchaikovsky. So
right.
We're really going back into musical biopics. But Tommy, man, now that is insanity.
Yeah, that, okay. Yeah, that's a good double feature.
Yeah. So Phantom of the Paradise, I'm going with that and Tommy.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Quadrophenia, I'm going with Rude Boy, which is a very similar approach where mix in the music of the Clash with a guy who wants to kind of be a roadie for the Clash.
Right. Yep. Interesting.
Yeah. So the Clash is in it and they play sort of like a fictionalized version of themselves. And the actor is so annoying that they all hate him. And basically in real life, they all hated the guy because the director told him to be a real jerky ass.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So he basically plays this really, and he hated it that people hated him, like, afterwards. They'd be like, oh, you're the biggest. And he was like, but I'm just being an actor. He's so good at it that you would think he's just a kid that was hired to be, like, in a documentary of the Clash, and you'd never understand that he was acting the whole time.
Okay.
So that's worth checking out just to see this guy's performance be a total dick and then know that he was basically directed to do it that way.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit like Rock and Roll High School, where you have the band playing a fictionalized version of themselves.
Yeah. See, we're breaking it now into the genres. We're going to come back and like organize. So we have Rock and Roll High School and then Rude Boy. Quadrophenia is a little different because it's just telling the Mods Rocker story.
Right.
With the Who is a backdrop. But then the characters that they talk about in their rock opera are the characters on screen. It's like, it's very meta.
It is very meta. But I think there's something in the rock and roll spirit about that, right? This, I mean, we haven't even talked about like the Beatles movies.
Ooh, yes. Right. Oh my God. How did we do rock and roll? We just said about the 60s and nothing, but we what a bad job we've done. Now I've like, you just blew my mind. We didn't talk about Hard Day's Night and then Help and Magical Mystery Tour.
And you know, Hard Day's Night is probably one of the most influential, it's influential as a movie, not just a music movie.
Oh, it's so good. And you know what, for years, and I feel like we've had this conversation offline, but for years, most of the copies you'd watch on TV, it was really hard to hear what the hell they were saying.
Yes.
Because they talk in, you know, pretty thick Liverpudlian accents, but Criterion has an edition. It may not be on the Criterion channel right now, but I have the actual Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And the print is so gorgeous and you can hear everything they say. It makes it so much funnier.
Yes, it is.
Hear everything they're
saying. It is hilarious. It's actually my 6-year-old daughter's favorite movie.
Oh, I wish I could get my kids to sit down and watch that.
She, if given a choice of what to watch, she'll pick it. She's seen it probably 14 times.
I love Ringo's sad day moment.
Yes.
You know, when Ringo gets to go walking around and he's kind of glum.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny though, like they're so appealing to a kid, right? There's something.
Oh, that's the thing is like, yeah.
They're so playful and so fun and not like regular adults. And so for a kid seeing them, it's sort of like, oh, wow, these people are really fun and hilarious and having fun going about their lives. The movie is so, it's shot like a documentary, but it's not staged like a documentary.
We know now, but I bet you kids growing up at the time had no idea that the guy who plays Paul's grandfather isn't really his grandfather.
Like, exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like people don't know. They don't tell you really that it's not. And it's just done in such a way that you would have no reason to think otherwise.
Right.
You know?
he's very clean, isn't he?
He's a nice old man, isn't he? He's very clean.
Well, yes, he's very clean. I know. Now we're just laughing and people are like, I haven't even seen this movie. What are they talking about?
If you haven't seen Hard Day's Night, you have to. I mean, that.
Oh, it's a staple. You got to see.
There's a few movies that we've talked about that are sort of required movies. And I would say Rocky Horror is one of them. And Hard Day's Night. Yeah. Hard Day's Night was one of the first movies I was shown in a class in my first semester in film school.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
It was a class called Language of Film. And it was, you know, just about cinematic grammar and things like that. And the first film that was shown was Hard Day's Night, because it has so many examples of different filmmaking techniques.
literally the studio that greenlit it and everything, and they wanted to get out in theaters. They literally wanted it shot and in theaters before their flash in the pan Beatles disappeared from teenagers' register. And instead, it not only enhanced what was already turning into, like, you know, an entire cultural moment, but the movie itself was brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant filmmaking, and it holds up as a movie, not just a Beatles movie. I can't say the same as much as I like it.
Is for Help.
Is for Help. I like Help, but it really kind of...
Though that's not easy to find. I mean, I guess you could buy it or something, but, like, they don't show that. I'm waiting for maybe Criterion to pop that up, because that would be great. Because I'd like to revisit that. It's been many years since I've watched it.
Well, I, of course, you know, the Hard Day's Night thing with my daughter... We did have to watch all the Beatles movies.
Even though it's like just like a little TV special, as a time, as a kid, I got to go to like a Beatles little mini marathon in Harvard Square and got to see Help and Let It Be and the Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, which we just shouldn't talk about.
But see, as a kid, though, I liked it. It really is just nothing more than a collection of videos. And as a kid, I was obsessed. I had that album. It was the first of the Beatles album that I purchased with my own money. And so I had that storybook, and I didn't know that, like, it was a movie. For some reason, I just looked at it as, like, pictures from a storybook. So when there was, like, a movie, I wanted to see it, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. Now, I have seen it in recent years, and it, you know, it's not very, very good.
It's not very – I mean, Help is basically a collection of videos, too.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a story, right, where they're trying to steal the special ring off of Ringo's finger.
There's a story, but the story just kind of breaks down at times, and they just sing songs and run around.
You know, it's funny, because we were talking about these, you know, we started talking about biopics and kind of a formula. Here's one, before we end up wrapping this up, that I think is an excellent film. Even if you're not a fan of the band or anything, it's just, it's a top-notch way to approach a musical biopic, and it's Control.
Which I have not seen.
It is so, so great. It's the story of the lead singer of Joy Division, who killed himself
right.
very young. But again, what it does is it takes more of a working man's approach to the story, that these people weren't just these, you know, showing a moment of them being a kid, getting introduced to their first instrument, and then suddenly hitting it big and then having a downfall.
Right.
It was more about, hey, you know, what do most bands, how do they get together? They're a bunch of friends and they may have jobs. Oh, and then they actually go and make music and somehow it gets a little popular. Like, that's kind of the approach of this movie.
Right. Shot. It's a little more low key.
It's presented in black and white. And it has a great central performance. It's a cool approach to making a biopic. And on that, have you ever seen 24-Hour Party People?
No, I haven't.
That is also another interesting biopic, because it also covers a little bit of Joy Division, but it covers the guy, was it Tony Stewart or Tony Sheridan or something? And he started the record company that signed Joy Division and the Happy Mondays. And
okay.
It's a really, Michael Winterbottom directs it, and it's just a weird approach. What I like, though, is, you know, it's a fourth wall breaking film.
Right.
Where the guy, I forget that comedian actor who plays the head guy, they have this great scene, and it's a tiny little, like, you know, like folding chairs set up in a tiny auditorium, you know, maybe about 30 people. And he addresses the camera and he's like, this may not seem like much, but it's actually a very important piece of history, because it's the very first time that the Sex Pistols ever performed together. And suddenly you're taken in this moment, and it kind of shows you like what it really looks like when a group first performs.
Right.
And it's very interesting, because that's kind of the approach that it's taking. And instead of these big sort of glamorized Hollywood setups, you get more something a little bit more raw and what it's probably really like for a band. So, I mean, there's all sorts of these weird oddities out there that people can search out.
Okay, I've got another weird oddity for you that this reminded me of.
Okay.
The Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Well, yeah, that's sort of, it's a very weird kind of documentary of sorts that's based on the Sex Pistols, which you could pair up with Sid and Nancy.
Which you could pair up with Sid and Nancy, exactly. And then, okay, another subgenre here.
Give it to me.
is typical biopics that follow the biopic formula, but they're about fake bands. I'm thinking of That Thing You Do.
Yes, right. Yeah, that really does follow the formula. You're right. But yeah, it's a fake band.
Totally follows the formula. Rockstar with Mark Wahlberg.
Okay, yes.
Follows the formula. I would even put Almost Famous in this category.
Have you ever seen...
I have not seen The Long Cut.
That's the only cut you should watch.
Okay.
It is... I own it. It is great. It is... If the producers hadn't effed it up and they let Cameron Crowe do that version, that film would have definitely been nominated for Best Picture.
Okay.
Director. It's really good. As a matter of fact, it's just one of those few times where a director's version, all the things that are put in there, they just make sense.
Okay. I've been wanting to see it for a while because
Untitled, it's called.
Yeah, Untitled. I liked it when I saw it in the theater. I didn't totally love it.
Yeah, that movie scratched me where I itch.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to watch this. I'm going to have to watch the long version.
Fake band stuff. You know, there's two movies out, right, that I haven't seen because, unfortunately, in today's day and age, they're not big hits, and I don't have an art house near me.
Yeah.
One is Volux.
Oh, yes. Vox Lux or Volux.
Vox, yeah. Lux, Volux. I don't know. Natalie Portman.
Right.
And then the other one is Her Skin. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think so.
It's got the handmaid there.
Yep.
Elizabeth Moss there. I do want to see those whenever they do show up on our streaming services.
Yeah, and a couple other fake bands. Spinal Tap.
Oh, well, okay. So now we're talking about like the quintessential everybody must see movies. Spinal Tap is...
Blues Brothers.
Have that on my list. We didn't get to it. We just got to it now. But, you know, in Spinal Tap, right? That's one that I feel like every podcast would talk about. But here's the one thing is, I'm one of the few people, I can actually tell that I saw it when it was in theaters.
Right.
For its first go around. I sort of had my eye on it. It was this, you know, read about it and it got great critical reviews. And movies like that usually debuted in Boston first as exclusives. And then if it was popular enough, it might trickle down into the suburbs. And that case it did. And my mom took me and my friend Robert to see it when it was at the Burlington Mall Theater. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, this was funny. A couple of parts really amused me. But I was like, what was it, 84 or 85? I think it was 84.
84, I think.
And so I was just about 14. And while, like I said, I thought it was funny, I remember it being very short. And I was kind of like, that's it. So a year or so later, it was at a revival screening at the Somerville, which is one of my, like, sort of my second home for movies. And they used to just show revival movies at that particular time. They didn't have new films.
Right.
They were showing Spinal Tap and maybe another film. My friend, same kid, Robert, and I said, let's go. So we do. But this time, this theater auditorium was about, I think it's like 900 seats.
Okay.
Probably close to a sellout, as you can imagine. All college age kids. So, right. To, you know, 4 years older to us, we're like, these were gods, right?
Yeah,
yep,
absolutely.
And this, again, it was another electric audience where every joke landed, everybody got it. And it was at that screening that I was like, I get it. This movie is the best.
And now,
did you catch it on video? Is that, I would imagine?
Yeah, I caught it on video.
Yep. At the video store?
At the video store, more than once. You were talking about the college kids at the video store. I was, I think, the only high school kid who worked there.
Right. So you were very influenced by these older kids.
Yes. And it was all these college kids who worked at the video store who would turn me on to movies. They'd say, oh, you should take this home. You know, I remember, like, they were movies I knew about, but I hadn't really tuned into. And so a lot of these college kids, I remember Raging Bull was one. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've heard of Raging Bull.
But you gotta watch. Here you go, kid. Take the video.
Exactly. Here you go. You're watching this tonight. And, you know, then I'm completely blown away by it.
Yeah, I honestly didn't have a guide. It sounds like because if you worked with these older kids, you know, you got to be someone who had a guide. Kind of had to find my own way through movies, through reputation and reading a lot about things because I didn't, you know, my parents... I guided them more than they guided me when it came to these movies.
Yeah, I was definitely, well, I was, yeah, the
guy. And I was a loser. I didn't have any friends, never mind college friends. You know, and then when I worked at the movie theater, right, they were all like high school kids, except that in the summertime, the beginning of the summer, this magic thing happened where the college kids came back.
Right.
And I remember the first year I worked at the theater in 86, and that season happening was like May. Suddenly, all of these kids looked like, they looked like adults to me.
Right,
they were just college kids, but they were all coming back. And I didn't understand, I'm like, who are these strangers coming into my environment? It's like, oh, these are the gods that we hushed tones. These are the college kids. And we worshiped them. And they ran the show, and they understood that we worshiped them, and they played like a role.
Of course.
And then several years later, when I was in college, I had stopped working at the theater for like a couple of years, but then I needed a job, and I got a job back when I was, you know, my sophomore year of college or something. Yeah. And then I was the college kid.
Right.
And it was the reverse. All these teenagers that worked, these young ushers, they worshipped me. And it was the funniest thing. They like literally anything I said or you got to do, or I made like these jokes, or I kind of created my own like memes from like movie lines and stuff. They worshipped. What can I do for you? Can I sweep the lobby for you? Whatever you got to do. Hey. Like, they just hung on you because you were the college kid and they worshipped you. When you came back at Christmas time, it was like, James is back.
I never got to that point at the video store. I really wish.
Because you were gone, right?
I went away to college and I didn't come back, and I really wish that I had gotten to be like the elder at the video store and introduce. Well, actually, no, I did. There was a high school kid at the video store at one point, and I introduced him. He was kind of this punk kind of kid, and I introduced him to A Clockwork Orange.
You introduced him?
Yes. I introduced him to it, and he really did not want to watch it because he was afraid that they have those funny accents. and I was like, I just said, dude, just take it home and watch it. And the next day he came back and he said, this is the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
I you know, that was a movie where the very first time I'd ever heard of A Clockwork Orange, I was sifting through the record bins because I was always into soundtracks. So when I was at a record store and I came across the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, and I just looked at the front cover.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this triangle and this guy coming out with like a knife and there's an eyeball. And I and then like these like sort of naked women statues. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell is this? And I looked at the back cover and I saw a few pictures of it. And then just, I'm like, I didn't know what it was. But like I made, you know, that was the brilliance of Stanley Kubrick,
yeah,
is that he understood like iconography and typography and all, yes, these things could emblazon themselves in your brain. So the images of Clockwork Orange stayed with me before I knew what the hell it was.
Yeah.
And of course, because it wasn't a movie that could ever play on regular TV, like, it, you know, even on
late night
or anything.
No, you're not seeing it.
And even then, they would never play it on cable. Like, there was just no way I could see this film until the video stores came along. And my parents, my parents had never seen the movie, so
right,
they didn't know. And I was like 14. I was the only kid that had a VCR. So naturally, like, when that thing showed up at the video store that we were going to, I was like, yeah, I want to watch this movie. Right? Still, my friend Glenn had heard rumors about it, you know, and of course, none of the things he said happened in the movie, or at,
right,
least he had thought, actually happened in the film. But, you know, I had him and this kid Robert over, and we watched it. And this kid Ed, that we were friends with, but he went to a different high school. So after junior high, we stopped hanging out with him, but we all watched it. And it was, you know, I just remember at the end of that film, which I really wasn't sure what my thoughts were on the film, but it was after that, it was the first time that I understood that the title of director meant something,
right,
that, yeah, shaped the movie, and that the way that the film was directed might be more important than like the acting or anything else. And it's just like,
right,
wow, this director's vision, That had a thing, and that's where Stanley Kubrick suddenly meant something to me.
Right, yeah, it's the name that pops out at you. With,
yeah, and that's when I was like, you know what, maybe, I was like into films, I wanted to be a film reviewer and stuff, but afterwards I was like, I think I want to make movies. And it literally, right, was after watching that film, that was the reaction I had, was, I think I want to make the films.
Yeah, I get that.
So again, it was just a film that just has, whether you like it or not, whatever it creates a reaction in your brain after you watch that movie. So okay. That has nothing to do with rock and roll.
We've gotten a little off topic here.
So listen, you, the listeners, if you like this episode or episodes, I think it's going to be, but you're like, I'd like them to spend more time talking about A, B, or C. Well, send us a message at Jim and Teal. Feedback at Jim and Teal.
Yes.
.com and tell us, and we will, consider it. Or just get in touch with us however you usually get in touch with us.
You can leave comments on the website. You can text us. You can Facebook message us. Whatever needs to be done.
Yeah, we have a website, people, in case you don't know, because sometimes, like, if you're already a subscriber and you just get the episodes, you may not realize that we do have a website. It's stuffweseen.com. And we, sometimes we put different content up there. We got the Will Ennial. He writes reviews and sticks them up on there, which we're always looking for more content. So, by the way, if any of you are savvy with the words and you want to contribute a review or something, let us know.
Yeah, we're definitely interested in people's film going experiences if you want to share those with us.
Yeah, or, we do have guests on the show, as you know.
Yes.
Last week we had our good pal, Michael. And, if you are desperate to hit the airwaves and you have something to say about films, you get in touch with us and we'll get in touch with you. How you can be on part of this extraordinary experience.
We'll communicate, yes. I think we should wrap it up, though.
Okay, I know. I'm having, it's a good topic and I enjoy it. Basically in theaters now, I don't think it's doing super well. So you might want to catch it soon as Rocketman. Yeah, I think it did okay, but for some reason, I don't know. I guess everybody really loves Queen, and which is why Bohemian Rhapsody. Plus also, this is my theory, is that this is, to me, the reason why Bohemian Rhapsody was such a big success is, if you think about it, there are like 30 years worth of people who have become Queens fans that literally never had the opportunity to see Freddie Mercury perform. He's been dead for a very long time. And I take that for granted because we lived in the time when Freddie Mercury was alive. And I remember when these songs were on the radio for the first time. And people want to feel like they could see him perform. And that is the magic. And I still will give that film credit.
Right.
That's what Rami Malek and why he got an Oscar is that for 2 hours, he gave people a chance to experience Freddie Mercury. And when he performs, that's when the movie's really on fire, especially during that concert. He puts a lot of energy and it does cross that magical wall of believability where you do believe that Freddie Mercury is alive.
Yeah.
Whereas in Elton John's case, people are like, well, he's still alive. I don't necessarily need to see his story.
Right.
I mean, it's just something about the fact that the artist is still alive and everything was okay, whatever. So there's not as much immediacy.
Yeah, I think that's true.
That's my theory.
I think the other thing is that Queen is, I think, more popular than Elton John right now. And not because
probably.
Not because of the movies, but like it, on classic rock, I don't know. There's some Elton John songs come on the radio, but I would say Queen songs I hear more frequently out in the world.
Yeah, I mean, okay, parting words here. Words, all right. Yeah, I have two, and I'll see if you have any.
Okay.
What would be your choice? What should be the next rock and roll biopic? What's a band or an artist that you'd love to see their story?
The Ronettes.
Okay, the Ronettes. I'm not greenlighting that movie because it's not going to make any money, but that could be very interesting, especially in dealing with the crazy, maniacal Phil Spector.
Yes, that's exactly Phil and Ronnie Spector, I think, would be an interesting story during that era.
Yep. And yeah, that whole area of the Wrecking Crew, et cetera. So,
yeah.
All right. So I think that's interesting. They're not going to make it, but it's interesting.
Well, it wouldn't have to just be the Ronettes. It could be a Wall of Sound movie.
Yeah, I like that idea. So that's a cool one. Here's my two. Mamas and the Papas.
Okay.
Because there's a lot, it would be great to have a real, a behind the scenes type of story because it is an epic story and it's really crazy. And I think that the music part is like one part of the story, but behind and how they all got together, et cetera, is very fascinating. And then two, Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, interesting.
Not a big Fleetwood Mac fan, but man, they just, their story is crazy. So those, and there's lots of fighting and that could be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted a Eddie Cochran movie, but the thing is, his story is actually really boring. Sure, he dies in a car crash.
Yeah, was it Gene Vincent? But he lived, but he was never quite the same.
Yeah, but it's not that interesting a story, as much as what like the music.
Phil Collins.
I
don't know why I'm laughing.
Why do we have an Elton John movie and not a Phil Collins movie, I guess?
I don't know. They would be, people would want to maybe see a Kurt Cobain story, perhaps, though it would be done terribly. And they did, what's it called? I forget, who made that movie, Last Days? It was kind of like
the Kurt Cobain story. That was kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
The guy at the drugstore cowboy. You know, I saw it. It wasn't bad. But I mean, they've already sort of done it, so I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's done. Let's see, who else would I like to... I mean, that's the thing. A lot of people the stories are not that interesting beyond the rise to fame and drugs and alcohol.
Like you said, it's a formula. It's been done. So, you know, I think what we've done today is at least... thrown out a bunch of titles, and some are more interesting than others.
Yeah.
Some, you know, are not easy to find, so you're going to have to really, search them out. But, keep a list. And I'll do what I'll be doing when these episodes come out, because now it's going to be episodes. There's no way. I'm not going to be able to cut this down into one episode, is I'll be posting pictures of various films that we talked about on our Instagram.
Fantastic. Yeah,
on the Stuff We've Seen podcast Instagram account. It's a great opportunity for me to put pictures up there from the movies we talk about. Check in for that. If you didn't know we had an Instagram, we do. And a lot of people who don't necessarily even listen to the show follow us on Instagram and enjoy the various pictures that I put up there.
Yes, movie stuff.
Kind of had a couple of things going with Jeff Goldblum the other day.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I go on these little kicks. I try to pick actors and some of their obscure roles and put the photos on Instagram.
Well, let's just do a Goldblum episode.
Yes. Actually, I would love to do a Jeff Goldblum episode. Jeff, if you're out there, please. We'd like to have you on the show.
Come on the show. We're going to do a Jeff Goldblum episode.
Yeah. Because he's done so many things.
Oh, he's fantastic. I'm a huge fan. Yeah.
He's been doing this. Okay, great. So you yourself should look at some of the pictures I posted on Instagram of Jeff Goldblum lately. But anyways, kids, it's been fun. Or at least for us, it's been fun. I don't know about for you, but...
thanks for listening.
And again, I'll have to do a different exit for whenever I decide to cut this episode in half. This will be the end of the second episode that you're listening to now. Which is great, because sometimes it takes us a while to get these episodes taped.
Exactly.
So now we have another episode to go. So see, look at that. We got two episodes for you.
And we'll be back again.
I think we will, right?
Yeah. We will be back again. Keep listening.
Yes. I'm not going to even tell you what we're going to talk about next, because I'm afraid then it'll curse us and you won't watch the movie. But we got something cool for you in the next episode. So stay tuned.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Bye.
So, come up to the lab and see what's on the slab. I see you shiver with anticipation. But maybe the rain is really to blame. So I'll remove the cause. But not the symptom.